Welcome to Inside Admission, the podcast that gives you a behind-the-scenes look at the college admission process with the experts in and around college admission.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Inside Admission podcast. I'm your host, Andy Palumbo, and I am thrilled to introduce our today's guest, Angel Perez. And so welcome to the podcast, Angel.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So why don't we start with you introducing yourself, a little bit about your role and your journey in higher education that brought you here.
Yeah, sure. So I'm currently the CEO of the National Association for College Admission Counseling, and we're an organization of about 26,000 members, including you, from all over the world who are helping students in the pipeline to higher ed. So mostly admission counselors, community-based organizations, school counselors, so on and so forth. But before that, I was in higher education. So I spent 22 years in admission offices, student success roles, and so know the work deeply on both sides. Also did a small stint at a high school as a college advisor, and also learned that is a really difficult job. And so really have a lot of empathy for the work that our members are doing out there.
So Angel, one of the things we've heard through much of our careers, nothing ever changes in admissions, right? You wash, rinse, repeat. And it seemed to be that way for a couple decades until about 2 years ago. And that really coincides with you stepping into this leadership role for our profession. Tell me a little bit about what that's been like, seeing the pace of change and the types of changes that have come down the pipe.
Yeah, you know, I think depending on where you sit, you might see it differently. I see it as really energizing because I have been one of the critics that I feel like, goodness, you know, especially in higher education, it's just, we move at a glacial pace. But I think the pandemic, as well as, you know, racial reckoning in this country, financial crisis has really sort of helped us move a little bit faster. And so to a certain extent, it was a really exciting time to step into this role because to really be at the helm of the organization that is the professional home of people like you who are doing the work and having to think about, one, how do we advocate at the national level around these issues? How do we become the voice? But also, how do we help our members, students, and families navigate this process that's changing? And, you know, the last 2 years, so much has changed. And we were just talking offline before we got on the podcast that even just this week, there's been all these announcements about all these changes and big impacts that are coming down the pike. So I find it incredibly exciting. And what I'm hoping on the other side is that a lot of these changes are for the better, and particularly that it's going to open the doors wider for marginalized students in this country and abroad.
So as you think about those marginalized students and students in general, if you had to name one or two things over the past few years that you think are the most significant changes, either now or setting the stage for the near future, what would you say those are?
Yeah, I guess the big one that everyone is pretty much aware of at this point has been the change in testing policies. The fact that over 1,800 colleges and universities in the United States, including big systems like the University of California, have gone test optional, or some have gone test blind, meaning that they won't even accept the exam. That is a fundamental shift in our society. You know, there, I think most people who went to college remember taking the SAT or the ACT, and it was just a ritual that we accepted in this society that you needed that in order to get into college. But a lot of, I think the pandemic pushed that conversation a little faster. Many schools were already test optional, but I think one of the big changes has been that it's dropping the test really does open the doors wider. And there's all this research that shows that the test is biased towards people who have a lot more income, towards students who have a lot of privilege. And so that is one barrier, in my opinion, that really has been removed and I think has changed the game.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, these standardized test scores have had longstanding problematic correlations with family income, with race and ethnicity, with gender. And, you know, we're now with the announcement this week of the, at least when we're taping, the digital SAT. You know, that marks the fourth iteration of the SAT in 25 years. You know, we've changed the vocabulary. We've changed the sections. We've changed the score. We've changed it back. but we haven't really put a dent in those inequities. And so to my mind, I have to agree with you. I think that seeing so many schools that maybe were in the process, maybe weren't even thinking about test optional, taking that leap. And now what we're seeing is a really thoughtful consideration now that schools have this data to really analyze it and see what that impact is, I think is dramatic. But to your point, the test blind, test free schools, schools that will not consider test scores regardless, WPI, I'm happy to say, made that change for this cycle and moving forward. But you've got the UC system, the CSU system looks like it's moving forward. You know, that's over, you know, 10% of the students in the country. And before this pandemic started, there's one college, you know, Hampshire. They were the only ones who were score free right before the pandemic. And we're rapidly approaching 100 schools. I think that that is such a fundamental shift. And I think it ties into the racial reckoning that you've brought up. I think the rise in the concern about inequities and the professionalization of admissions officers and certainly school counselors have played a huge role in advocating for students and advocating for, you know, DEI and social justice issues. So it's, I agree with you. I think it's an energizing and exciting time to be in the profession.
Yeah, I would also say, especially if you're a student or a parent listening to this, that another thing that I think has shifted, and it was already growing, but I think the pandemic accelerated it, is I sort of call it the democratization of information, in the sense that, you know, colleges and universities, they did things online, they did some webinars, but the pandemic really forced colleges and universities to fundamentally shift their recruitment model. And so that everything they were doing in person, they had to do online. And, you know, we had to do that here at the National Association. We run college fairs throughout the country pre-COVID, and we had to take those online. And when we did our first college fair back, I got an email from a student in Iowa who said to me, "Thank you for hosting this college fair, because all of the schools I talked to would have never come to my tiny town in rural Iowa." And it was an eye-opening moment for me that, like, wow, this actually is providing more information and more connectivity for students. Obviously, still lots of issues and that we need to work through, but I do think there's more access to information now than there ever was before. And I also think that's a benefit for students.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, you and I have talked before. That's really the genesis of this podcast, is trying to just grab folks who are friends, who are colleagues, and, you know, just squeeze that expertise right out of them, you know, through the mic, you know, through the screen, and make it accessible for people, you know, make it on demand content so that as people are going through the process, they can get quick tips and expertise and understand what's happening on the back end. You know, I think that that type of context is critical. I, you know, when I was thinking about the podcast, I was thinking about every time I go to buy a car, right? You don't do it that often. And so it's intimidating. You walk in, there's all these hidden rules. You don't know what's happening. I know I'm a mark. I know they're making money off me. I just don't know how. And you know, and then it's, everything happens so quickly and you're looking at the paper and you're trying to follow what's happening. They've got this lingo. And then you walk out and you're like, what just happened? And I think that a lot of people feel that way about exactly. A lot of people feel that way about college admissions. And so, you know, this is my small attempt to try to get folks like you to share your wisdom and expertise with the students, parents, and counselors who are listening. So, but one part of this podcast, a tradition we have, is also to bring in the human component. And so one of my favorite things to do is to ask our guests about their own college search process. So Angel, why don't you tell us a little bit about your path to higher education and you know, any lessons you may have learned from that you want to share?
Yeah, my story might be a little bit different than others, but actually, as I think about it, probably resonates with a lot of low-income kids. So I was a low-income, first-generation student to college. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico and then moved to the South Bronx in New York when I was a teenager. And, you know, my parents didn't really have the knowledge about college in the United States. I went to a massive high school, 4,000 kids in a building. in New York City. And so, you know, college advising was very limited. So I was very fortunate, though. I did have a school counselor who tapped me on the shoulder one day and said, young man, have you ever thought about going to college? And I call that the pivotal transformative moment in my life, because I guess philosophically I had thought about it, but I didn't have any reality around what that meant. And so I ended up applying to school with the help of this school counselor, and ended up going to college in upstate New York, Skidmore College. And that experience for me was just transformative. And I will say, the way that I did it, I would not advise anyone to do it today. I applied to like two schools, which probably is not a great idea. You need some options. But also, again, I just didn't have the knowledge or the mentorship to really guide me through that process. And so, you know, the first thing I would say is seek out some help. And there are probably really good, talented counselors in your school. If not, look for a local community-based organization, because the system still is pretty complex. And so it's important to have you be guided through that process. But I was grateful for my experience. And in many respects, it's why I do this work, because I realized that I was pretty fortunate. I was one of the few that left my high school and had that experience. And I don't want that to be the case for future generations. I want everyone to have that opportunity.
And so as complex as the admissions process is, and as daunting as it is, you know, it is inextricably linked to the financial process as well. And, you know, in 2022, you know, affordability is probably as important, if not more important, than admissibility. And so, you know, when you and I talked about doing this podcast, you know, I asked you what you wanted to talk about. And, you know, one of the key things you wanted to talk about was having the conversation about financing your education and the college admissions process. And so I'm curious, you know, what are your thoughts on that, and how families should approach this? It's a very real part of the process. And I think that, you know, many parents are unsure when to talk about it, how to talk about it. We all want what's best for our children, but there's also a balance. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm really passionate about this subject because I have a lot of personal experience when I was on a campus as a chief enrollment officer, where at the very end of the process, families would come to visit the school that I was at, and the parents would say, can I talk to you in your office away from my child? And they would sit down, and this was like 2 weeks before the enrollment deposit was due, to talk about affordability, or I can't really afford this, or my child doesn't know X about our financial background. And it actually made me really sad that I felt that, you know, it's really important to have the financial conversation as early as you can. And also just to sort of put all the cards on the table around the difference between what you can afford and what you are willing to pay, which are two very different things. And so depending on where you are on the economic spectrum, I think it's really important for families just to begin to have that conversation, but also to begin to have the conversation because it might also inspire you to fill out more applications for scholarships or to go through that free financial aid form together, or the CSS profile, which is a form that many private colleges require. So the earlier you have that conversation, I think the better. You know, I'm someone who really believes that if you do this process well, and I mean the admissions and financial aid process, you can actually become closer as a family because you have to ask yourself difficult questions, not just about what do I want and, you know, what do I value, but also what can I afford and what does education mean to us?
I think that's a great point. You know, a lot of the guests I've spoken to so far have talked about, you know, how critical it is to have an open line of communication, you know, with your child who's going through the process. But we all know that that's also a time where, you know, those children are gaining autonomy and they have private lives and they may come in from school, go right up to the bedroom, shut the door. So any tips for how to make time and space for the college search process while also, you know, putting aside time for just that the family connection. You know, this is the last full year for many students who are going off to residential schools. Any tips on how to manage that balance and how parents can approach this?
Yeah, I love that you asked this question, because the best advice I got about this, it doesn't come from me. It actually came from a student who told me this. I was doing a program. I was a speaking engagement in Los Angeles at a school. And I was talking to parents about how to de-stress and not put too much emphasis on this or that. And a student came up to me afterwards and he says, "My parents and I figured this out." And what he said to me was that he created the College Power Hour. And he said, every Tuesday, my parents and I sat down to dinner and we talked college, and they could ask me anything they wanted, whether I wrote the essay, whether I'm on track, whether I'm filing the deadlines. After that, they can't talk to me about college until next week. And it was actually a really brilliant thing that this family did, because they were able to compartmentalize a little bit. What I tend to hear from students, especially once they become juniors in high school, definitely seniors, is that everyone around them, that's all they want to talk about. And we have to remember that these are young people that, like you said, have lives and have so many other things going on, that we want them to stay engaged. We want them to be excited about the college admissions process and not feel drowned by it. So, you know, create your own version of that College Power Hour, where you put some parameters and some guardrails around it as a family. And I think that will help the student feel like you're engaging, but you're also not taking over the process.
That's excellent advice. Thanks for sharing that. So, you know, we spend in our roles and in our conversations with families so much time focusing on the things that happen through the search process, through the application process, making that final decision, covering financial aid. And then at some point, a deposit is made, or, you know, the May 1st national deposit deadline passes. And then it's summer. And very often you've lost high school supports in school counselors. Maybe if you're working with community-based organizations, that may be there as a continuous support or not. But the summer is sort of uncharted territory for many families, especially those who it may be their first child to go off to college. And so much time and energy has been focused on the process that I think we don't spend as much time preparing for the transition. And so this is another topic you wanted to speak about today. And I'm really curious your thoughts on, you know, how to navigate that in a way that, you know, you're still able to have that balance of family time and appreciating the togetherness, but also preparing for college.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. It is a point that I think we don't talk about enough, because we're so focused on getting in, and then you get in and you're celebrating, but you don't realize there's another journey ahead of you that you need to start gearing up for. And in my last role in higher education, I oversaw the student success component. So I spent a lot of time really thinking about how do you make sure that students transition from that admissions process into retaining at schools successfully. And I would say, you know, you use the word around connectivity. I think it really is important that students stay connected to their institutions. And so students will probably find, and maybe they might find it a little annoying, but over the summer, your school will be emailing you. Your school will be saying, here is a portal where you need to go in and constantly check. And I would say you definitely want to be engaging that way. And making sure you're checking your emails and staying in touch, but also slowly but surely beginning to connect with people on the campuses as well. Oftentimes over the summer, that's when you'll learn who your roommate is going to be. That is when you're going to learn a little bit of information of who might be in your classes. And so one of the ways that students sometimes take the fear out of this anxiety that they're going to feel that they're going to show up on a campus and not know everyone is actually reaching out early. And also I would say, you know, again, this is a great way to become close to your family, having those conversations around what is it that you're nervous about, and, you know, what is anxiety producing about moving from high school to college. I think that's actually really important. But again, that I think, like I mentioned around the College Power Hour, putting parameters around that so that's not all you're talking about over the summer. And I know this is probably not what parents expect me to say, but I also really encourage students during the summer before college, have some fun, have a good time, Be a high school / college student. Go out there because you actually just finished this incredibly intense academic marathon. And guess what? You're about to get on another one that is going to take another 4 years. And then you're going to be busy looking for a job, so on and so forth. So this also really is one of the final times in your life where you should just chill. And I think that will help you be better when you arrive on campus. I'm sure you've seen this, Andrew, at WPI, given the rock stars you tend to recruit into your institution, that they're probably exhausted by the time they get there because they've been, you know, academically challenged for so long to earn the reward of going to WPI. By the time they get there, they're burned out. So also work on that burnout issue over the summer.
Yeah, and this is a thread I want to follow up on a little bit.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at InsideAdmissionPodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is Inside Admission, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Now, back to the pod.
But because, you know, as parents, you know, we just want to do right, but we want to set our students up for success. But also I think there's at least an academic understanding that they need to build their own autonomy and they need to be preparing to advocate for themselves. What are things parents can do during those summer months leading up to, you know, help students transition from this really dependent world where they wake up at a certain time, maybe their parents help them, you know, get on the bus or get to school, or they're out the door walking to school by a certain time, they get into school, there are fixed classes, there are teachers and administrators looking out for them, to an open-ended summer with the unknown, and then getting to a place where you're expected to be much more autonomous, where you're expected to seek out the help you need. It's a major change. And what can parents do to help facilitate that change during the summer so that it's not an abrupt change when students get to campus in the fall?
It's a great question. And I think the advice I'll share, I really learned from my friends who have children who have done this well over the years. I've had friends who, for example, absolutely stopped waking up their children. Even in the senior year of high school, it's like, well, it's your job to get to high school and no one's going to be there in your dorm in your first year of college. And that transition is important. But also as a parent, you have to be patient because there may be days that the child does not wake up, right? Sure. And they have to learn that lesson and stumble. And so to a certain extent, you have to be patient. A lot of my friends also have their kids start doing their own laundry, have their kids once a week learning how to cook a couple of meals, because even though they know that they're going to be in the dining hall during their college experience, they may move in with roommates off campus, or they may decide to not take a meal plan. And so just knowing how to make basic things is something that I think has been a really fun transition for parents, and also a bonding experience, again, where you could spend some time with your child. But, you know, just making sure that more and more between the senior year in high school and the summer before college, that you are making fewer of the decisions for your students, or your children rather, and really letting them take the lead.
Yeah. And you mentioned letting them stumble, and that seems sort of counterintuitive in this college admissions process, where I think despite what college admissions officers might say, parents and students sort of feel as if they need to showcase themselves and they need to be perfect. Yet what many of them would benefit from is failure. And so, you know, talk a little bit about when you're in admissions, you know, you're in an admissions office and maybe an admissions committee, you know, how is failure viewed? You know, when you see a student has stumbled or failed at something, what are admissions officers saying? What is that conversation like, and how is that being evaluated?
I think the first thing I would say is that failure is not an automatic deny in the process. It's all spoken about in context. And, you know, over my career, I have admitted probably hundreds of thousands of students over time who, you know, failed a course, or maybe didn't do as well, or stumbled along the way, or made a mistake and was put on probation or something like that, that we recognize. I think a lot of the public doesn't see folks like you and I who've had these roles as humans, We are also adults. Some have children. You know, we have also grown up and have seen ourselves stumble, that oftentimes we have deep empathy skills that we bring to the admissions table. So I would say, you know, if you have stumbled, if you have failed, to make sure you just contextualize it. And most importantly, I think admission officers really love when you talk about what you've learned from it, because in the end, this is still an educational process and we are educators. But Andrew, I do think what you mentioned is really important, because I saw this on the other side when the students arrived. Students have spent so much time working on being perfect and getting everything right, that the first time they fail in college or do not get the grade that they want, they literally deteriorate. I used to see that, like the breakdowns in my office. And so I think that one of the ways that parents can help make that transition a little bit better is to let them stumble, not always feel like you have to pick up behind them, not always feel like they have to do it right or perfect, because then when they arrive in college, and at some point in college, they will not do as well. The work is definitely much more intense. They will learn some lessons or fail at something. We don't want them to crumble. We want them to have that muscle memory of what that feels like and be able to get up faster. And what I worry about with this generation is that they haven't been given enough room to fail.
Yeah, talking about students arriving on campus and stumbling and having that be, such a negative experience because it may be the first time they've been allowed to fail. It feeds into something I've seen more and more of over the years, and that is students struggling with imposter syndrome. You know, students who maybe were in the middle of their class in high school or at the higher end, and they feel good about where they're at. They feel that they've accomplished things, that they are successful in their academics, and then they arrive at a college and they're surrounded by incredibly bright people. My first class at Union College, imposter. I was in a small seminar with 10 students, and every single one of them was smarter than the next one. And, you know, like one of them is now a math professor at Berkeley who cracked some, you know, unbreakable math theorem. So some of it may not be imposter. Some of it might've been legitimate, but for those students who are, feeling that imposter syndrome, what advice would you give to them? And I think often students suffer with this internally. And so who would you recommend they reach out to as well?
Well, if you don't mind, I'd love to tell a personal story. So it Please. Wasn't in I'd had imposter syndrome my whole undergrad. But I don't know if this will inspire people or make them want to run, but I had it deeply my first year in graduate school. So I went to Columbia University, and Columbia has, you know, a name and a brand. And I just felt like everyone there must be smarter than me. For sure. Like I didn't even understand, like, how did I get in here? And during my first course at Columbia, I took my first exam. And when the professor, this was when we still did everything by paper, when the professor handed back the exam, I did not look at the grade. Everyone immediately in the course was looking at the grade. I stuffed it in my bag and I walked 5 flights of stairs down the building, 5 blocks in New York City, took a bus all the way home, walked up my 5 flights of steps to my apartment, and I closed my door in my bedroom because I just knew that I certainly was not smart enough and that I probably failed this exam, only to whip it out and see that I had gotten an A in the course. But it was a very powerful moment for me because I felt like, wow, that was really dramatic. Like you were so not confident of your skills that you couldn't even look at the grade. But here's the secret that I think everyone needs to know. Every single person feels imposter syndrome at some point in their life. And most people on college campuses are walking around with imposter syndrome because it's new. It's very rare that someone walks onto a college campus and feels like, I know everything here. Even if your parents went to college, like it's a new language, it's a new culture. I used to tell the students on my campus, particularly the first generation students who didn't have parents who can sort of walk them through this, that college is a skill to be learned. It's a language. right? I bet you, totally. Andrew, when you got to Union, like, you didn't know what the bursar was, or like, what are office hours? Is that required? Am I supposed to go? Do I get in trouble if I don't go to office hours? So the funny thing is, those of us who have spent our lives in higher education, we speak this language that we assume students should know, right? And so part of what higher ed is trying to do a better job of is not making that mystery, right? But I will say imposter syndrome is real. But the advice I would give to people, and what I constantly remind students of, is if you were admitted to the institution, you belong and you can do the work there. That is why you were admitted. But know that everyone around you has this sense of insecurity, and that's okay. And I would say it's okay to talk about it.
Thanks, Angel. So I have a few more questions. One, while we're getting a little personal, you know, I think it's great for us to show the human side of the people who work in this field, because I think very often, you know, all that's left is either your imagination, your anxiety, filling in, you know, the most intimidating scene possible, or Hollywood, which is so far from reality. So, you know, I'm curious. What do you think, you know, there's sort of a saying in this work, you know, you're in this field for 2 years or for 20, you know, and there tends to be sort of a moment when you know, or when you decide, yeah, this is something I want to do. Did you have one of those moments? And if so, why don't you share it with us?
You know, I think I did. I probably had moments. You know, I would say when I was sitting in a high school surrounded by 50 students telling the story of the school that I was recruiting for, and I saw the energy and I saw that light going off for them, and I remembered myself as a high school student and not really being able to imagine what college could be like, I realized, wow, admissions officers paint a window for students to peek into around what their lives could be like. Like, I found that incredibly exciting. But I would say one that was really another aha moment for me was the first time that I went to the New York State ACAC conference. So NACAC, the national association that I run, has 23 affiliates around the country and the world. And so I went to the New York one. And that is when I realized that college admissions, it's such a beautiful community. It's people who went into the work, who care deeply about young people. They want to get more young people into college. It's also a really fun community. It's full of people who really enjoy, you know, being together. And so for me, that's when I realized, wow, this is more than just a profession or a job. Like, this is a community and a cohort. And so many of my friends, till this day, are people who are in the field. So I would say those were the two moments. It was being at a school and being engaged, but also going to a conference and realizing, look at all the thousands of people who want to do this as well. How exciting is that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I got my start in New York State ACAC, and I think that community and that sense of shared commitment to students and to the work that we do definitely is a part of what kept me in this work as well. So speaking about that commitment to students, you know, Angel, as long as I've known you, you've been a strong advocate for students. You're well respected by your colleagues in admissions for the guidance that you provide to students. We've talked about a lot today, but what haven't we touched on that you want to share with students?
Gosh, that's a good question. There's so much I would like to share. I would say, you know, I get this question sometimes around what do you wish you had known, or what would you do differently? And the reality is, now that I sit in this chair, and also I've had the honor of, because of this, the job that I've had in higher education, I've traveled all over the United States, all over the world. There are so many incredible colleges and universities. I am forever grateful to Skidmore College in upstate New York. Changed my life. I would not change that for the world. But also, I know a lot now about schools, and I realize that I could have been a great student probably at hundreds of colleges all over the United States who are interesting and have really great curricula that that I could take advantage of. So, you know, my message is always about open-mindedness and realizing that there's so many different schools out there, not just the name brand, but also that based on where you live, you may not have been exposed to those schools, right? And so just being open when that counselor tells you, you might want to consider X or Y school that you've never heard of, doing the research. And again, pointing back to what we mentioned earlier, there's so much more information out there for you. You know, when I went to college, I couldn't do a virtual tour. Like, that wasn't a thing when I applied to college. And so I couldn't imagine myself there. And so there's so much more information. So be open, because you might be surprised where you end up going.
Absolutely. And so for the parents, any parting pieces of advice or words of wisdom?
Yeah, I would say I understand that this is easier said than done, but you know that the student really does have to be the driver in this process. And that can be difficult. I think oftentimes this is the first time in a child's life where you are saying, you are actually going to lead and I'm going to follow. And obviously you're there for support, you're there for counsel, you're there for course correcting, but at the same time that the student really does need to lead, and also that you need to let the student go through the highs and the lows of the process. You know, I've had friends who are parents who went through this process and they're, you know, they get frustrated with their kids because they were like, they change their mind every 2 weeks about the kind of school that they want to go to. Let that happen naturally, and they will eventually get there with your support.
Well, before we close out, I do want to give you the opportunity, although NACAC is a professional association supporting those of us working in the field. You do a great deal of service for students and families directly. Is there anything you want to share with folks to make sure that they're aware that NACAC is a resource for?
Yeah, I'd love to point out two things. One, come onto our website, NACACnet.org. There's lots of resources there where you could learn about the college admissions process. And we're also going to be doing a revamp to our website. So by the fall, there will be a lot more resources there. But also, I want to mention that we do host college fairs. Currently, we are hosting them online. But we are also in March going to start hosting college fairs around the country. We're starting in Miami, and we will be doing other fairs throughout the country. And we're going to have our big comeback. I was about to say post-COVID, but I'm starting to believe that COVID is just here, and that's not a thing. But we will have a big sort of reinvention of the college fairs this fall as well. So go onto our website, see if we're coming into your area, and we'd love to see you at one of our fairs.
That's exciting. Thanks, Angel. And you know, it's as always, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate you joining us in the Inside Admission podcast, and hope you have a great day, Angel.
Thanks for having me and for doing this.
Absolutely.
Enjoying the podcast? Find us on the web at InsideAdmissionPodcast.com. And you can find and engage with us on social media, where our handle is Inside Admission, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.